Good morning, and welcome to Lopes on Movies. My name is Joey Lopes, and today I am joined by Connor.
Good morning, Joey. How you doing?
Hey, Connor, how you feeling? You're the only one joining us today. We don't have a third person, which I think it's been a little while since we haven't had a third person, I feel like, but it's just that kind of day, you know? We're recording this on Halloween, which is pretty exciting.
That's right.
You know, how are you feeling?
Happy
Halloween, everybody.
Great.
Keep feeling good on Halloween? I know that your street is having like a big party or something. Like there's a lot of noise outside your window.
Yep, so I'm recording from my closet.
So, but that's good though. I think that's actually better for the show than if you were recording in your room, because the closet has like all the clothes hanging down and all this stuff that can like deaden the sound of the microphone so you don't get all the echoes. So that's a little bit of inside baseball for all you people out there learning how to get good quality sound. It's good when there's not a lot of echoing happening in the room. So sometimes furniture, clothes, that kind of stuff can actually really help. So you should record from the closet all the time, Connor. I feel like that's probably the better place for this show to make it sound as professional as possible.
Got it? I mean, probably not going to do that, but I got it. Yeah, I understand.
Sure.
Yep.
I get it. Well, anyway, it is Halloween, so of course, you know, we could have been talking about everybody's new favorite movie, the Five Nights at Freddy's movie, which I almost saw as a bit. I very, very strongly considered going to the theater to see it, but
what is the word on the street, Kyle, about, you know, Five Nights at Freddy's?
That's actually a really interesting question, Connor. I was going to say, I considered asking Kyle to go see it with me, and he never responded, so I assume that was a no. But ultimately, I kind of got the impressions of what people were thinking about it from various different places. Because if you look at, like, critical reviews, it's, like, universally despised. Like, they hate it. Like, they think it's just, like, a horrible cash grab, not even scary. The animatronics that the series is so famous for are not even in it that much, apparently, which I think is particularly funny. But I should tell you that a lot of the students here that I've talked to enjoyed the movie quite a bit. And you got to understand that Five Nights at Freddy's is something that only really Zoomers can understand. Like, I think that it's purely a thing that appeals to people that were born after the year 2000. Like, I don't think anybody else really cares about Five Nights at Freddy's or knows anything about it. And I think that it's the you know, post-2000s kids that grew up with Five Nights at Freddy's and are invested in the lore, which, if you could believe it or not, they are very invested in the lore. This movie works for them. They enjoy it. They think it's fine. They don't really see what the big problem is with, you know, all these reviewers not liking it.
So I mean, it's based off a video game, right? Like it. I mean,
yeah. Well, that's what Five Nights at Freddy's is.
Yeah, and then the video game is based off of like a Chuck E. Cheese kind of thing, like a kid's
Showbiz Pizza type thing.
Yeah, Showbiz Pizza kind of stuff.
That's like even older, but yeah, the idea of like the. Yeah, the animatronic animals that, you know, perform music or whatever they do. Like, this is just like a play on that where they're like evil. I think that in the game, there's like a character, like you play as a character who has to like guard this place overnight for some reason. And then like the animatronics come to life and try to kill you or something. And
that's,
you have to,
it's a survival game. Yeah.
I think I watched somebody play it once and I was like, well, I could see this being kind of scary, but it looks kind of boring to play. I don't know. But again, I can't get it. I'm incapable of getting it because I was born, you know, in the 90s. You have to be born after the year 2000 to appreciate Five Nights at Freddy's or like anything about it. Maybe this movie is just the same way.
What do you think Martin Scorsese would say about Five Nights at Freddy's?
It's a franchise picture. You know, I don't think he's interested in the franchise pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know. I just like... To me, I still just am not that interested in seeing very many movies based on video games, especially not a video game like Five Nights at Freddy's that I already had absolutely no interest in. Like, there's just no way it could be like a real movie, you know? Like, there's just way too much riding on it being I don't know if cash grab is the right word, but like, you know what I mean? Like, it can't possibly be good. I just don't buy it. I don't buy that there could possibly be a good Five Nights at Freddy's movie. I don't know.
Well, I don't know.
We'll never know because we're not going to see it. I think the window of opportunity to see the Five Nights at Freddy's movie for us has passed. There was a brief window last weekend where I almost did it as a joke, and I'm sure I would have hated it, but alas, it's not to be. I think it's actually streaming on Paramount Plus right now too, though,
which I think is funny.
So all of us could just put it on, you know, or find an illegal copy of it on the internet. Just kidding, of course, we would never do that. You know, that's you crazy? Absolutely not. No, we would never do that for a movie like Five Nights at Freddy's or the Super Mario Brothers movie. It would never happen, ever.
Of course not.
But, alas, we're not talking about that because, you know, we just didn't see it. We already kind of talked about our scary movie a couple weeks ago when we, when we talked about Suspiria. So I feel like we're kind of letting people down by not doing a true Halloween episode.
Yeah, but it's today. November. But for the release of the episode, it's November 1st. We're moved on.
That's true.
You know, it's over.
That's true. It's good to start talking about other things now that Halloween is over, and that's exactly what we're gonna do today. So I think me and you, Connor, we've seen a couple of things lately, just kind of movies that we've been watching randomly. So let's start with the one that you saw. So I know that you told me that you just recently watched The Godfather Part 3, which I've never seen. I've only heard of the, you know, kind of reputation that it has. So I'm very curious what your impression of that is. And your impression of the first two, just for context.
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, I love The Godfather Part 1 and 2, which I also came to fairly late. You know, I always heard that it was great, and I knew all the iconic lines from it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I love those movies. You know, the story of Vito Corleone and Michael Corleone's rise to power, basically from the bit. You saw The Godfather,
of course.
Sure.
Of course. And it's been a long
knows
time.
The Godfather. Then so the first one is more the it's still the kind of the transition from Vito Corleone to Michael Corleone, one of his sons, might have been, I think it's his youngest son, actually, who takes over the family.
Yeah, it's his youngest son.
But he didn't intend to. Like, he was a soldier. Like, he didn't want to be part of the family business, but kind of got, like, sucked into it. And then you slowly see him, like, kind of just get wrapped up more and more in the world. And, like, as much as he has in the back of his mind that he wants it to be a legitimate business, he's still doing such evil things to get them to that point. But the way he centers himself is, you know, I'm only going to do this, and this is what I have to do. I can get us legitimate, and then we are no longer involved in this kind of, you know, nefarious business world. And, that's the first one. By the end, he's still a little more redeemable. By Godfather Part 2, he's not a likable character anymore. No, definitely not. The switch has definitely gone the entire other way. It's fascinating to watch, and I do think both are great in different ways. The Godfather Part 2, you kind of get in the film. It's very confusing, especially when just watching it the first time. You're kind of piecing together the strategy that Michael Corleone, who is played by Al Pacino, what he has to do to get to figure out how he's going to maneuver himself to be in the best situation with so many different characters that are all plotting against him, and he's plotting against them. Very fascinating, mm-hmm. but it's pure evil. The character that you knew from the first one, who's kind of got dragged into this world, is like gone.
It's completely gone by that point.
But it's fascinating. And then you're also getting the story of his father and his progression and his immigration from Italy to
the flashbacks
with, yeah,
Robert De Niro plays.
Yeah, so Robert De Niro plays him, and then of course he iconically in The Godfather, it was
Marlon Brando.
Marlon Brando, of course, Marlon Brando. So the two iconic actors, both of whom won Best Supporting Actor for the same role. I think that's the first time ever. So then you get to The Godfather Part 3, which is a movie that they come back to years after Godfather Part 2. And I mean,
yeah, it was sort of a fraudulent sequel, right? Like, it came out like almost like 15 years later or something.
It came out like way later. Yeah. So it came out in 1990. And like, when did The Godfather Part 2 when did that one come out? Like, The Godfather Part Two was, let's see, it was 1974. So it was quite a bit of time.
A long time.
Since. Yeah. But, and also, so the books are, or it's based on the story by Mario Puzo, who, the story for The Godfather Part Three is not from his original book, The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of created the story for this one. And I'll tell you, the story on its own is very fascinating. It's like, you see where Michael would be after years of trying to get his company, you know, his family's businesses legitimate. And you see that he's actually pretty successful doing it. You also see that he's infiltrated him into society as this great philanthropist, that there's also a whole scenario where he's heavily involved with the Catholic Church and the Vatican, and essentially like tying his finances in with theirs. It's very fascinating, like the story that they're trying to pull off. However, like, and this is, I'm breaking no new ground here by saying that the movie does suffer from two particularly big problems, which is not having Robert Duvall back for The Godfather Part Three. He was the faithful lawyer of the family and Michael's stepbrother in The Godfather Part One and Two, Tom Hagen. Not having him in The Godfather Part Three changes so much, and especially because the guy that they got to replace him is just this nothing character.
Oh no, they kept the character,
they didn't keep the character. It's a different lawyer. And they just say that Tom Hagen died, but the part needed to be Tom Hagen. Like he was such a fascinating character, because you could even kind of tell by the end of The Godfather Part Two, he wasn't totally in line with the way Michael was going down. And I think there were so many different versions of a Godfather Part Three script that has been passed around for forever. And I think there was actually thought that if Robert Duvall did do the picture, it would have been a very different story, and it might have been.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like the main storyline might have been those two kind of coming to a head of, like, and there would have one of, you know, basically battling for the end of you know, of where the family would end up going, you know, for right and wrong, and like how they're both you know, calculating like the maneuvers to get there. So very different. I think the reason it came down to money. Robert Duvall found out that Al Pacino was getting like something like 3 or 4 times more than he was getting paid. And he was like, look, I can understand if you pay me half, but come on, don't insult me by, you know, if Al Pacino's making $5 million, I'm making like, you know, way less than that. Then you can't do that. So that was a big flaw. And then the other one is that they couldn't, a central character in the story was Michael's daughter. And they could not find someone to play the role after a bit of time, Winona Ryder was attached to the role, who would have been perfect. Actually, she was the perfect age. She kind of looks like she could be the daughter of Al Pacino and Diane Keaton.
I could see that actually, yeah.
And Diane Keaton.
You mentioned it, yeah.
It would have been perfect, and the character kind of like it was a central character who was like involved in the plot and is has to be charismatic. And after she like dropped out of the picture fairly late in the game, Coppola decided to just cast his daughter, Sofia Coppola. And it was really the wrong choice, because she's working opposite like titans like Al Pacino, Diane Keaton. And, you know, I mean, there's other just tremendous actors. Andy Garcia plays Vincent Mancini in the movie. And he's tremendous too. And she is just not a professional actor like they are.
Yeah.
And it's so noticeable, and it really brings down the picture every time that she's in it.
I was wondering about that, because that's kind of like she's often gets the blame for why that movie's not good. And I've always been wondered if that's like a little bit overblown, or if she really is just that bad.
No, it's really not. But. And I mean, and she, so the other aspect of the movie that you get pretty quickly is that there's this weird incest plot in the movie.
Ugh.
like with a cousins. So Andy Garcia, Vincent Mancini, who is Al Pacino in the movie, you know, so Michael Corleone's oldest brother's like son, and his daughter. So you know, Sofia Coppola's character, I think her name is Mary,
mm-hmm.
they kind of have like some kind of budding romance in it, and they're cousins. So it's already like weird on that front. And then when you don't have a super strong actor on there, also it just really makes it kind of strange.
That's a lot of work to put on an unprofessional actor for such a challenging storyline like that.
Yeah, it really is. And it's just like, because you don't buy it and it just feels weird and it just takes you out of it because she's just not great in it, it makes it just more strange that it's like this incest plot. Like, I don't know why there's so many incest plots in stories in general, like that it's people are so fascinated by this. And like, I think the characters in the movie, like Michael Corleone and Kay, who's Diane Keaton, is his ex-wife, are kind of like, and they're not okay with it, but they're not as appalled as I think they should be by like cousins. Like, I don't know. But the fact that they just, between the chemistry between Andy Garcia and Sofia Coppola just doesn't really work is a big problem. Those are the main things. Overall, like, the story and the structure, I think, is pretty admirable. I mean, I love the plot, and I think Andy Garcia was great as the heir apparent of, you know, the family. There's a lot of good stuff in it. Like, I think Al Pacino is tremendous in it also. Like, I don't know if you, did you know that line, "Think I was out and they pulled me back in," you know, that's from The Godfather Part 3 though. Like, people
everyone knows that.
But like the, one of the most iconic lines is from the one that's considered the worst loved, you know, it's just, I think the movie as a whole, I think it's a little bit of a bad rap, but I do understand the criticisms, and it's not even in the league of The Godfather Part 1 and 2. Yeah. But it does leave you, after you watch it, you feel the sense of, this could have been so much better if it just a few things, if they got Winona Ryder, if they just paid the money to get Robert Duvall in the picture. Duvall. You know, for a movie,
missed opportunity.
That was essentially a cash grab of like going to a sequel, you know, how many, you know, years and years later after last movie, it's pretty good.
Well, we can forgive Sofia Coppola just because she did become a fairly well-respected director.
She did. After, I love Lost in Translation. I'm actually going to see her new movie,
Priscilla.
Priscilla
comes out this weekend, which I'm pretty looking forward to that. I think that's going to be interesting because that's, of course, about Elvis's wife, Priscilla. Priscilla Presley, and the guy they cast as Elvis, I think they did a good job casting Elvis in that movie, which is funny because like there was the Elvis movie from like last year or whatever, where they had Austin Butler or whatever doing that ridiculous voice, and I don't think that he really looks the part that much, but this guy Jacob Elordi or whatever his name is, he absolutely looks the part, and it's very funny, like the two actors like playing Priscilla and Elvis. You have Jacob Elordi playing Elvis, who's like a million feet tall, and then the girl is like really short, and them together, it's like such a strange and interesting image. But of course, that's what the movie's about, the fact that like Elvis married her when she was like 16 or something ridiculous like that.
Yep.
So it's going to be fascinating for sure. And of course, Sofia Coppola is the perfect person to delve into a story like that. So I'm definitely interested in checking that one out. But, you know, it's funny that you bring up Winona Ryder, Connor, because the movie that I watched over the weekend had Winona Ryder in it.
Oh, wow.
It was probably, like, at least around the same time that The Godfather Part 3 came out, which is, of course, well, we just watched the Killers of the Flower Moon, and I just having watched that, I was like, well, I have a couple of other Scorsese movies that I've wanted to... you know, get off the backlog, because I haven't seen every Scorsese movie. I've seen a lot of them, but not all of them. So I was like, you know, I've always wanted to watch The Age of Innocence, which is his kind of like unusual period piece movie. You could call it a costume movie, even. It takes place in the 1880s or something, 1870s. And it's all about like wealthy society in New York City at the time. So it seems at first glance like kind of an unusual topic for Martin Scorsese, but when you actually like start watching it, you can kind of see what attracted him to this, like this kind of story. But of course, this was early 90s, so yeah, 1993. So yeah, right around the same time almost as The Godfather Part 3. So that's kind of funny. But yeah, this stars Daniel Day-Lewis in the lead role as Newland Archer, and then also Winona Ryder and Michelle Pfeiffer as the two female leads. So yeah, have you heard anything about this movie, Connor? I feel like this is one that sort of flies under the radar a little bit, but because it's so unique in Scorsese's filmography, people are kind of aware of it.
Yeah, only that if I need to go and see it after watching so much Marty stuff recently for Killers of the Flower Moon. It's on the list. So that's it.
Yeah. It's on the Criterion Channel, actually. And there's some nice special features and stuff available. So definitely an easy one to check out if you have the Criterion Channel, which, of course, I highly recommend, as I always do. But yeah, so this one was based off a novel by Edith Wharton, a very, very old novel. And it basically deals with this character, Newland Archer's relationship with these two women, played by Michelle Pfeiffer and Winona Ryder. Winona Ryder being a character who he has kind of decided to marry, and Michelle Pfeiffer's character being a character that sort of tempts him away from the marriage. But it's all about this, the way that you are supposed to behave in society around that time, and what the culture does to people's behavior. The thing that's so interesting about it, like when I was watching it, the thing that struck me first was that the way that Scorsese tells the story, with just the way he chooses to frame the shots, the way he chooses to move the camera, and his editing especially, and even some special effects that are in the movie, it's all very, very expressive. Whereas the characters themselves are kind of like confined by the culture of the time and can't fully express or do what they want to do. They have to follow all of these kind of arcane, like, social rules about if you know what I mean. So just like stuff like everything is about, like, if you're invited to a party, you have to attend, or else it's a slight against the people that invited you. There's a whole bit early on in the movie where Michelle Pfeiffer's character, the whole crux of the story is that she's sort of like left her husband, and her husband lives abroad, and there's all of this kind of chatter among like the socialites of New York about her doing this, because that's not something that you do. So she kind of has this bad reputation coming back, but she's not fully aware of this reputation. So a lot of the chatter amongst the people is against her, and the Newland Archer is early on, like, she is the, I think, the cousin of Winona Ryder's character, or at least they're related. So what they hatch this scheme to announce their wedding at this ball that everyone's going to attend in order to try to divert attention away from people talking about Michelle Pfeiffer's character showing up, and what her just to try to divert attention away from talking negatively about her. There's one point where people they try to host a party to basically just for the sake of Michelle Pfeiffer's character to get people invested and come back to her. And a lot of people, and basically everybody says they're not going to attend. So it's a huge slight against her, and they have to come up with like another way to try to reintegrate her back into the fold. And you get like all these very like kind of interesting like things that are not said by the characters, but that are said, where they're all very tied to tradition. And you can tell that, like, even if they don't explicitly say something against a certain character, you can tell exactly what they're thinking and how judgmental they can be. But the thing that's so interesting about it is that, so like I said, like all of what Scorsese does in the filmmaking is expressive to try to explain like how these characters are feeling. So there's a ton of shots of just like the environment that they're in, and all like the furniture and the table settings and all this like lavish stuff, like all of the stuff that the wealthy people of society in New York would have to arrange for parties and stuff. And it creates this like very oppressive atmosphere, because even though it's all so lavish and beautiful and gorgeous, it's like all these people have to be, they have to obey by the rules of all of the stuff and all of this, the stuff in the society that they are a part of. And the thing that's really interesting is that Newland Archer, he kind of considers himself as somebody who is a little bit above it all. Like, he feels like he understands that everybody's kind of a little bit fake, and that he is going to sort of break out of it. And sort of his relationship with Michelle Pfeiffer's character, who he like gradually really falls in love with, and a lot of like the yearning of the movie comes from those two characters. And the sort of like, will the romance happen question is so like agonizing. Like it's very, very like just charged emotionally. But his relationship with that character is very much a part of his sort of like, I want to break free of all of this stuff. But the interesting thing is the question of whether or not the other characters in the movie who he thinks of as being sort of beneath him and like all tied to tradition, whether or not they're actually like, they may be more clever than he's giving them credit for. And especially with Winona Ryder's character, which I won't spoil anything about where the movie goes, but it's very, very interesting how it resolves and how the Newland Archer character resolves and everything with the love triangle. It's just Scorsese can do no wrong. You know, this is a masterful like story where the filmmaking technique is so perfectly tied to the story being told in every moment. And there's so many like just clever, unique touches, like characters when characters are reading a letter from another character, you'll get just like a shot of that character speaking to the camera in whatever location they're at, which is kind of like it's a strange device. But again, it's like it's all about just getting that expression across and getting like the emotion across. So you want to see that character like talking through their letter rather than just like reading the letter out loud. But there is a great moment where like Newland Archer is reading a letter from I think from Michelle Pfeiffer's character, and like all the light in the room goes out except for just light on his eyes. Again, just like a totally expressive thing that doesn't make sense like realistically, but it's like it's all about getting the emotions of the moment through more so than like the like logic of what the lighting would be in that scene. And as soon as that happens, it's like just such a charged moment, you know, because you can just see the emotion in his eyes like so strongly. There's a couple of like iris shots, which are not very common in just movies in general. It was more of a like really, really old cinema technique. But like there's a couple of those as well, just to like hone in on certain characters of the frame. So he pulled out every trick in the book to tell this story in as compelling a way as possible. And yeah, it's great. Like it's phenomenal. And the ending is like super sad and romantic, and it's everything you could ever want from a romance, like a tragic romance movie. And like it's funny because like I said, all that like that the wealth and stuff that they have, and all of the dresses and elaborate dinners and elaborate furniture and table settings and like dining stuff, you know, all that stuff is like so oppressive, but it's also really gorgeous. This is one of the most gorgeous movies that I think Scorsese's ever made.
Yeah, like, I think it won an Oscar actually for like the design or something. I was looking. Yeah. Like I think maybe the wardrobe or something.
It's beautiful. And even beyond just the wardrobe, like there's just some like exterior shots that are just beautiful. It's gorgeous. It really is phenomenal. So I would strongly recommend checking this out and not sleeping on it just because it's not a Scorsese movie about gangsters, which everybody loves. Everybody loves his gangster movies, but then you come out and, you know, ask to watch The Age of Innocence and you're like, oh, I don't know. You know, that's maybe not for me, but it's for everybody. This movie's for everybody.
This got a ton of attention at award season too. Yeah. It did win, for best costume design. It was a nominee for best art direction and set decoration. It was a nominee for best original score.
Oh yeah, it's a great score too, Elmer Bernstein.
Yeah, and it was nominated for best writing too, Jay Cox.
And Martin
Scorsese.
I think they also collaborated more recently on Silence. That was the more recent thing that they did. So yeah, I like how Scorsese he kind of works with like not always the same people, but with a sort of like rotating cast of people over time. I think also Gangs of New York they worked together on. Mm. So around that time period. But,
nice. Oh, that's good. I got to throw in Winona Ryder was a nominee for best actress in a supporting role for this one.
And she's great. So yeah, check it out. It's a great one. But we will catch you next week for something.